Guardians of the Truth. The criticism is sometimes leveled against rationalists. The Inquisition thought they had the truth. Clearly, this truth business is dangerous. There are many obvious responses, such as, if you think that possessing the truth would license you to torture and kill, you're making a mistake that has nothing to do with epistemology. Or, so that historical statement you just made about the Inquisition, is it true? Reversed stupidity is not intelligence. If your current computer stops working, you can't conclude that everything about the current system is wrong and that you need a new system without an AMD processor, an ATI video card, even though your current system has all these things and it doesn't work. Maybe you just need a new power cord. To arrive at a poor conclusion requires only one wrong step, not every step wrong. The Inquisitors believed that 2 + 2 = 4, but that wasn't the source of their madness. Maybe epistemological realism wasn't the problem either? It does seem plausible that if the Inquisition had been made up of relativists, professing that nothing was true and nothing mattered, they would have mustered less enthusiasm for their torture. They would have also been less enthusiastic if lobotomized. I think that's a fair analogy. And yet, I think the Inquisition's attitude toward truth played a role. The Inquisition believed that there was such a thing as truth, and that it was important. Well, likewise Richard Feynman. But the Inquisitors were not truth seekers. They were truth guardians. I once read an argument, I can't find the source, that a key component of a zeitgeist is whether it locates its ideals in its future or its past. Nearly all cultures before the Enlightenment believed in a fall from grace, that things had once been perfect in the distant past, but then catastrophe had struck and everything had slowly run downhill since then. In the age when life on earth was full, they loved each other and did not know that this was love of neighbor. They deceived no one, yet they did not know that they were men to be trusted. They were reliable and did not know that this was good faith. They lived freely, together, giving and taking, and did not know that they were generous. For this reason, their deeds have not been narrated. They made no history. The Way of Chuang Zi, translated by Thomas Merton. The perfect age of the past, according to our best anthropological evidence, never existed. But a culture that sees life running inexorably downhill is very different from a culture in which you can reach unprecedented heights. I say culture and not society, because you can have more than one subculture in a society. You could say that the difference between, for example, Richard Feynman and the Inquisition is that the Inquisition believed they had truth, while Richard Feynman sought truth. This isn't quite defensible, though, because there were undoubtedly some truths that Richard Feynman thought he had as well. The sky is blue, for example, or 2 + 2 = 4. Yes, there are effectively certain truths of science. General relativity may be overturned by some future physics, albeit not in any way that predicts the Sun will orbit Jupiter. The new theory must steal the successful predictions of the old theory, not contradict them. But evolutionary theory takes place on a higher level of organization than atoms, and nothing we discover about quarks is going to throw out Darwinism, or the cell theory of biology, or the atomic theory of chemistry, or 100 other brilliant innovations whose truth is now established beyond reasonable doubt. Are these absolute truths? Not in the sense of possessing a probability of literally 1.0, but they are cases where science basically thinks it's got the truth. And yet, scientists don't torture people who question the atomic theory of chemistry. Why not? Because they don't believe that certainty licenses torture? Well, yes, that's the surface difference. But why don't scientists believe this? Because chemistry asserts no supernatural penalty of eternal torture for disbelieving in the atomic theory of chemistry? But again, we recurse and ask the question, why? Why don't chemists believe that you go to hell if you disbelieve in the atomic theory? Because journals won't publish your paper until you get a solid experimental observation of hell? But all too many scientists can suppress their skeptical reflex at will. Why don't chemists have a private cult which argues that non-chemists go to hell, given that many are Christians anyway? Questions like that don't have neat single-factor answers, but I would argue that one of the factors has to do with assuming a productive posture toward the truth versus a defensive posture toward the truth. When you are the guardian of the truth, you've got nothing useful to contribute to the truth but your guardianship of it. When you're trying to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry by discovering the next benzene or buckyball, someone who challenges the atomic theory isn't so much a threat to your worldview as a waste of your time. When you are a guardian of the truth, all you can do is try to stave off the inevitable slide into entropy by zapping anything that departs from the truth. If there's some way to pump against entropy, generate new beliefs along with a little waste heat, that same pump can keep the truth alive without secret police. In chemistry, you can replicate experiments and see for yourself. And that keeps the precious truth alive without need of violence. And it's not such a terrible threat. If we make one mistake somewhere, end up believing a little untruth for a little while, because tomorrow we can recover the lost ground. But this whole trick only works because the experimental method is a criterion of goodness, which is not a mere criterion of comparison. Because experiments can recover the truth without need of authority, they can also override authority and create new true beliefs where none existed before. Where there are criteria of goodness that are not criteria of comparison, there can exist changes which are improvements rather than threats. Where there are only criteria of comparison, where there's no way to move past authority, there's also no way to resolve a disagreement between authorities, except extermination. The bigger guns win. I don't mean to provide a grand, overarching, single-factor view of history. I do mean to point out a deep psychological difference between seeing your grand cause in life as protecting, guarding, preserving, versus discovering, creating, improving. Does the up direction of time point to the past or the future? It's a distinction that shades everything, casts tendrils everywhere. This is why I've always insisted, for example, that if you're going to start talking about AI ethics, you had better be talking about how you are going to improve on the current situation using AI, rather than just keeping various things from going wrong. Once you adopt criteria of mere comparison, you start losing track of your ideals. Lose sight of wrong and right, and start seeing simply different and same. I would also argue that this basic psychological difference is one of the reasons why an academic field that stops making active progress tends to turn mean, at least by the refined standards of science. Reputational assassination is tame by historical standards. Most defensive posture belief systems went for the real thing. If major shakeups don't arrive often enough to regularly promote young scientists based on merit rather than conformity, the field stops resisting the standard degeneration into authority. When there's not many discoveries being made, there's nothing left to do all day but witch hunt the heretics. To get the best mental health benefits of the discover, create, improve posture, you've got to actually be making progress, not just hoping for it. Guardians of the Gene Pool. Like any educated denizen of the 21st century, you may have heard of World War II. You may remember that Hitler and the Nazis planned to carry forward a romanticized process of evolution, to breed a new master race, supermen, stronger and smarter than anything that had existed before. Actually, this is a common misconception. Hitler believed that the Aryan Superman had previously existed, the Nordic stereotype, the blonde, blue-eyed beast of prey, but had been polluted by mingling with impure races. There had been a racial fall from grace. It says something about the degree to which the concept of progress permeates Western civilization that the one is told about Nazi eugenics and hears, "They tried to breed a superhuman." You, Dear reader, if you failed so hard that you endorsed coercive eugenics, you would try to create a superhuman. Because you locate your ideals in your future, not in your past. Because you are creative. The thought of breeding back to some Nordic archetype from 1,000 years earlier would not even occur to you as a possibility. What? Just the Vikings? That's all? If you failed hard enough to kill, you would damn well try to reach heights never before reached. Or what a waste it would all be, eh? Well, that's one reason you're not a Nazi, dear reader. It says something about how difficult it is for the relatively healthy to envision themselves in the shoes of the relatively sick, that we are told of the Nazis and distort the tale to make them defective transhumanists. It's the communists who were the defective transhumanists. New Soviet man, and all that. The Nazis were quite definitely the bioconservatives of the tale. Guardians of Ayn Rand. For skeptics, the idea that reason can lead to a cult is absurd. The characteristics of a cult are 180 degrees out of phase with reason. But, as I will demonstrate, not only can it happen, it has happened, and to a group that would have to be considered the unlikeliest cult in history. It is a lesson in what happens when the truth becomes more important than the search for truth. Michael Shermer, The Unlikeliest Cult in History. I think Michael Shermer is over-explaining objectivism, and I'll get around to amplifying on that. Ayn Rand's novels glorify technology, capitalism, individual defiance of the system, limited government, private property, selfishness. Her ultimate fictional hero, John Galt, was, spoiler, a scientist who invented a new form of cheap, renewable energy, but then refuses to give it to the world since the profits will only be stolen to prop up corrupt governments. End spoiler. And then, somehow, it all turned into a moral and philosophical closed system, with Ayn Rand at the center. The term closed system is not my own accusation. It's the term the Ayn Rand Institute uses to describe objectivism. Objectivism is defined by the works of Ayn Rand. Now that Rand is dead, objectivism is closed. If you disagree with Rand's works in any respect, you cannot be an objectivist. Max Gluckman once said, "A science is any discipline in which the fool of this generation can go beyond the point reached by the genius of the last generation." Science moves forward by slaying its heroes, as Newton fell to Einstein. Every young physicist dreams of being the new champion that future physicists will dream of dethroning. Ayn Rand's philosophical idol was Aristotle. Now, maybe Aristotle was a hot young math talent 2,350 years ago, but math has made noticeable progress since his day. Bayesian probability theory is the quantitative logic of which Aristotle's qualitative logic is a special case, but there's no sign that Ayn Rand knew about Bayesian probability theory when she wrote her magnum opus, Atlas Shrugged. Rand wrote about rationality, yet failed to familiarize herself with the modern research in heuristics and biases. How can anyone claim to be a master rationalist, yet know nothing of such elementary subjects? Wait a minute, objects the reader. That's not quite fair. Atlas Shrugged was published in 1957. Practically nobody knew about Bayes back then. Bah. Next you'll tell me that Ayn Rand died in 1982 and had no chance to read Judgment Under Certainty, Heuristics and Biases, which was published that same year. Science isn't fair. That's sort of the point. An aspiring rationalist in 2007 starts with a huge advantage over an aspiring rationalist in 1957. It's how we know that progress has occurred. To me, the thought of voluntarily embracing a system explicitly tied to the beliefs of one human being, who's dead, falls somewhere between the silly and the suicidal. A computer isn't 5 years old before it's obsolete. the vibrance that Rand admired in science, in commerce, in every railroad that replaced a horse and buggy route, in every skyscraper built with new architecture, it all comes from the principle of surpassing the ancient masters. How can there be science if the most knowledgeable scientist there will ever be has already lived? Who would raise the New York skyline that Rand admired so if the tallest building that would ever exist had already been built? And yet, Ayn Rand acknowledged no superior in the past or in the future yet to come. Rand, who began in admiring reason and individuality, ended by ostracizing anyone who dared contradict her. Shermer. Barbara Brandon recalled an evening when a friend of Rand's remarked that he enjoyed the music of Richard Strauss. When he left at the end of the evening, Ayn said, in a reaction becoming increasingly typical, "Now I understand why he and I can never be real soulmates. The distance in our sense of life is too great." Often she did not wait until a friend had left to make such remarks. Ayn Rand changed over time, one suspects. Rand grew up in Russia and witnessed the Bolshevik Revolution firsthand. She was granted a visa to visit American relatives at the age of 21, and she never returned. It's easy to hate authoritarianism when you're the victim. It's easy to champion the freedom of the individual when you are yourself the oppressed. It takes a much stronger constitution to fear authority when you have the power. When people are looking to you for answers, it's harder to say, "What the hell do I know about music? I'm a writer, not a composer." Or, "It's hard to see how liking a piece of music can be untrue." When you're the one crushing those who dare offend you, the exercise of power somehow seems much more justifiable than when you're the one being crushed. All sorts of excellent justifications somehow leap to mind. Michael Shermer goes into detail on how he thinks that Rand's philosophy ended up descending into cultishness. In particular, Shermer says, it seems, that objectivism failed because Rand thought that certainty was possible, while science is never certain. I can't back Shermer on that one. The atomic theory of chemistry is pretty damned certain, but chemists haven't become a cult. Actually, I think Shermer's falling prey to correspondence bias by supposing that there's any particular correlation between Rand's philosophy and the way her followers formed a cult. Every cause wants to be a cult. Ayn Rand fled the Soviet Union, wrote a book about individualism that a lot of people liked, got plenty of compliments, and formed a coterie of admirers. Her admirers found nicer and nicer things to say about her. Happy death spiral. And she enjoyed it too much to tell them to shut up. She found herself with the power to crush those whom she disapproved, and she didn't resist the temptation of power. Ayn Rand and Nathaniel Brandon carried on a secret extramarital affair, with permission from both their spouses, which counts for a lot in my view. If you want to turn that into a problem, you have to specify that the spouses were unhappy, and then it's still not a matter for outsiders. When Brandon was revealed to have cheated on Rand with yet another woman, Rand flew into a fury and excommunicated him. Many objectivists broke away when news of the affair became public. Who stayed with Rand rather than following Brandon or leaving objectivism altogether? Her strongest supporters. Who departed? The previous voices of moderation. Evaporative cooling of group beliefs. Ever after, Rand's grip over her remaining coterie was absolute, and no questioning was allowed. The only extraordinary thing about the whole business is how ordinary it was. You might think that a belief system which praised reason and rationality and individualism would have gained some kind of special immunity, somehow. Well, it didn't. It worked around as well as putting a sign saying "cold" on a refrigerator that wasn't plugged in. The active effort required to resist the slide into entropy wasn't there, and decay inevitably followed. And if you call that the unlikeliest cult in history, you're just calling reality nasty names. Let that be a lesson to all of us. Praising rationality counts for nothing. Even saying you must justify your beliefs through reason, not by agreeing with the great leader, just runs a little automatic program that takes whatever the great leader says and generates a justification that your fellow followers will view as reasonable. So where's the true art of rationality to be found? Studying up on the math of probability theory and decision theory, absorbing the cognitive sciences like evolutionary psychology or heuristics and biases, reading history books. Study science, not just me, is probably the most important piece of advice Ayn Rand should have given her followers and didn't. There's no one human being who ever lived whose shoulders were broad enough to bear all the weight of a true science with many contributors. It's noteworthy, I think, that Ayn Rand's fictional heroes were architects and engineers. John Galt, her ultimate, was a physicist. And yet, Ayn Rand herself wasn't a great scientist. As far as I know, she wasn't particularly good at math. She could not aspire to rival her own heroes. Maybe that's why she began to lose track of the will to keep improving herself. Now me, you know, I admire Francis Bacon's audacity, but I retain my ability to bashfully confess, if I could go back in time and somehow make Francis Bacon understand the problem I'm currently working on, his eyeballs would pop out of their sockets like champagne corks and explode. I admire Newton's accomplishments, but my attitude toward a woman's right to vote bars me from accepting Newton as a moral paragon, just as my knowledge of Bayesian probability bars me from viewing Newton as the ultimate unbeatable source of mathematical knowledge. And my knowledge of special relativity, paltry and little used though it may be, bars me from viewing Newton as the ultimate authority on physics. Newton couldn't realistically have discovered any of the ideas I'm lording over him. But progress isn't fair. That's the point. Science has heroes, but no gods. The great names are not our superiors, or even our rivals. They are past milestones on our road. And the most important milestone is the hero yet to come. To be one more milestone in humanity's road is the best that can be said of anyone. But this seemed too lowly to please Ayn Rand. And that is how she became a mere ultimate prophet. Two cult koans. A novice rationalist studying under the master Oji was rebuked by a friend who said, "You spend all this time listening to your master and talking of rational this and rational that. You have fallen into a cult." The novice was deeply disturbed. He heard the words, "You have fallen into a cult," resounding in his ears as he lay in bed that night and even in his dreams. The next day, the novice approached Oji and related the events and said, "Master, I am constantly consumed by worry that this is all really a cult and that your teachings are only dogma." Oji replied, "If you find a hammer lying in the road and sell it, you may ask a low price or a high one, but if you keep the hammer and use it to drive nails, who can doubt its worth?" The novice said, "See, now that's just the sort of thing I worry about. Your mysterious Zen replies." Oji said, "Fine then, I will speak more plainly and lay out perfectly reasonable arguments which demonstrate that you have not fallen into a cult. But first, you have to wear this silly hat." Oji gave the novice a huge brown 10-gallon cowboy hat. "Master," said the novice. "When I have explained everything to you," said Oji, "you will see why this was necessary. Or otherwise you can continue to lie awake nights wondering whether this is a cult." The novice put on the cowboy hat. Oji said, "How long will you repeat my words and ignore the meaning? Disordered thoughts begin as feelings of attachment to preferred conclusions. You are too anxious about your self-image as a rationalist. You came to me to seek reassurance. If you had been truly curious, not knowing one way or the other, you would have thought of ways to resolve your doubts. Because you needed to resolve your cognitive dissonance, you were willing to put on a silly hat. If I'd been an evil man, I could have made you pay 100 silver coins. When you concentrate on a real-world question, the worth or worthlessness of your understanding will soon become apparent. You are like a swordsman who keeps glancing away to see if anyone might be laughing at him. All right, said the novice. You asked for the long version, said Oji. This novice later succeeded Oji and became known as Na no Taki. Ever after, he would not allow his students to cite his words in their debates, saying, use the techniques and do not mention them. A novice rationalist approached the master Oji and said, Master, I worry that our rationality dojo is, well, a little cultish. That is a grave concern, said Oji. The novice waited a time, but Oji said nothing more. So the novice spoke up again. I'm sorry, but having to wear these robes and the hood, it just seems like we're the bloody Freemasons or something. Ah, said Oji, the robes and trappings. Well, yes, the robes and trappings, said the novice. It just seems terribly irrational. I will address all your concerns, said the master, but first you must put on this silly hat. And Oji drew out a wizard's hat, embroidered with crescents and stars. The novice took the hat, looked at it, and then burst out in frustration, how can this possibly help? Since you are so concerned about the interactions of clothing with probability theory, Oji said, it should not surprise you that you must wear a special hat to understand. When the novice attained the rank of grad student, he took the name Bozo and would only discuss rationality while wearing a clown suit.
Cargo Cult Science by Richard P. Feynman. Some remarks on science, pseudoscience, and learning how not to fool yourself. Caltech's 1974 commencement address. During the Middle Ages, there were all kinds of crazy ideas, such as that a piece of rhinoceros horn would increase potency. Another crazy idea of the Middle Ages are these hats we have on today, which is to lose in my case. Then a method was discovered for separating the ideas, which was to try one to see if it worked, and if it didn't work, to eliminate it. This method became organized, of course, into science, and it developed very well so that we are now in the scientific age. It is such a scientific age, in fact, that we have difficulty in understanding how witch doctors could ever have existed when nothing that they proposed ever really worked, or very little of it did. But even today I meet lots of people who sooner or later get me into a conversation about UFOs or astrology or some form of mysticism, expanded consciousness, new types of awareness, ESP, and so forth. And I've concluded that it's not a scientific world. Most people believe so many wonderful things that I decided to investigate why they did. And what has been referred to as my curiosity for investigating has landed me in a difficulty where I found so much junk to talk about that I can't do it in this talk. I'm overwhelmed. First, I started out by investigating various ideas of mysticism and mystic experiences. I went into isolation tanks, they're dark and quiet and you float in Epsom salts, and got many hours of hallucinations, so I know something about that. Then I went to Esalen, which is a hotbed of this kind of thought. It's a wonderful place, you should go visit there. Then I became overwhelmed. I didn't realize how much there was. I was sitting, for example, in a hot bath, and there's another guy and a girl in the bath. He says to the girl, I'm learning massage and I wonder if I could practice on you. She says okay, so she gets up on the table and he starts off on her foot, working on her big toe and pushing it around. Then he turns to what is apparently his instructor and says, I feel a kind of dent. Is that the pituitary? And she says, no, that's not the way it feels. I say, you're a hell of a long way from the pituitary, man. And they both looked at me. I'd blown my cover, you see. And she said, it's reflexology. So I closed my eyes and appeared to be meditating. That's just an example of the kind of things that overwhelm me. I also looked into extrasensory perception and PSI phenomena, and the latest craze that was Uri Geller, a man who is supposed to be able to bend keys by rubbing them with his finger. So I went to his hotel room on his invitation to see a demonstration of both mind-reading and bending keys. He didn't do any mind reading that succeeded. Nobody can read my mind, I guess. And my boy held a key and Geller rubbed it and nothing happened. Then he told us it works better underwater. And so you can picture all of us standing in the bathroom with the water turned on and the key under it and him rubbing the key with his finger. Nothing happened. So I was unable to investigate that phenomenon. But then I began to think, what else is there that we believe? And I thought then about the witch doctors and how easy it would have been to check on them by noticing that nothing really worked. So I found things that even more people believe, such as that we have some knowledge of how to educate. There are big schools of reading methods and mathematics methods and so forth, but if you notice, you'll see the reading scores keep going down or hardly going up, in spite of the fact that we continually use these same people to improve the methods. There's a witch doctor remedy that doesn't work. It ought to be looked into. How do they know that their methods should work? Another example is how to treat criminals. We obviously have made no progress. Lots of theory, but no progress in decreasing the amount of crime by the method that we use to handle criminals. Yet these things are said to be scientific. We study them. And I think ordinary people with common sense ideas are intimidated by the pseudoscience. A teacher who has some good idea of how to teach her children to read is forced by the school system to do it some other way, or is even fooled by the school system into thinking that her method is not necessarily a good one. Or a parent of bad boys, after disciplining them in one way or another, feels guilty for the rest of her life because she didn't do the right thing, according to the experts. So we really ought to look into theories that don't work and science that isn't science. I tried to find a principle for discovering more of these kinds of things and came up with the following system. Anytime you find yourself in a conversation at a cocktail party in which you do not feel uncomfortable that the hostess might come around and say, "Why are you fellows talking shop?" or that your wife will come around and say, "Why are you flirting again?" then you can be sure you are talking about something about which nobody knows anything. Using this method, I discovered a few more topics that I had forgotten. Among them, the efficacy of various forms of psychotherapy. So I began to investigate through the library and so on, and I have so much to tell you that I can't do it all. I will have to limit myself to a few little things. I'll concentrate on the things that more people believe in. Maybe I will give you a series of speeches next year on all these subjects. It will take a long time. I think the educational and psychological studies I mentioned are example of what I would like to call cargo cult science. In the South Seas, there is a cargo cult of people. During the war, they saw airplanes land with lots of good materials, and they want the same thing to happen now. So they've arranged to make things like runways, to put fires along the sides of runways, to make a wooden hut for a man to sit in, with two wooden pieces on his head like headphones, and bars of bamboo sticking out like antennas. He's a controller. And they wait for the airplanes to land. They're doing everything right. The form is perfect. It looks exactly the way it looked before. But it doesn't work. No airplanes land. So I call these things cargo cult science because they follow all the apparent precepts and forms of scientific investigation, but they're missing something essential. Because the planes don't land. Now it behooves me, of course, to tell you what they're missing, but it would be just about as difficult to explain to the South Sea Islanders how they have to arrange things so that they get some wealth in their system. It is not something simple like telling them how to improve the shapes of their earphones. But there is one feature I noticed that is generally missing in cargo cult science. That is the idea that we all hope you have learned in studying science in school. We never explicitly say what this is, but just hope that you catch on by all the examples of scientific investigation. It is interesting, therefore, to bring it out now and speak of it explicitly. It's a kind of scientific integrity, a principle of scientific thought that corresponds to a kind of utter honesty, a kind of leaning over backwards. For example, if you're doing an experiment, you should report everything that you think might make it invalid. Not only what you think is right about it, other causes that could possibly explain your results, and things you thought of that you've eliminated by some other experiment and how they worked, to to make sure the other fellow can tell they have been eliminated. Details that could throw doubt on your interpretation must be given if you know them. You must do the best you can. If you know anything at all wrong or possibly wrong, to explain it. If you make a theory, for example, and advertise it or put it out, then you must also put down all the facts that disagree with it, as well as those that agree with it. There's also a more subtle problem. When you have put a lot of ideas together to make an elaborate theory, you want to make sure, when explaining what it fits, that those things it fits are not just the things that gave you the idea for the theory, but that the finished theory makes something else come out right in addition. In summary, the idea is to try to give all the information to help others to judge the value of your contribution, not just the information that leads to judgment in one particular direction or another. The easiest way to explain this idea is to contrast it, for example, with advertising. Last night I heard that Wesson oil doesn't soak through food. Well, that's true. It's not dishonest, but the thing I'm talking about is not just a matter of not being dishonest, it's a matter of scientific integrity, which is another level. The fact that should be added to that advertising statement is that no oil soaks through food if operated at a certain temperature. If operated at another temperature, they all will, including Wesson oil. So it's the implication which has been conveyed, not the fact, which is true. And the difference is what we have to deal with. We've learned from experience that the truth will out. Other experimenters will repeat your experiment and find out whether you were wrong or right. Nature's phenomena will agree or they'll disagree with your theory. And although you may gain some temporary fame and excitement, you will not gain a good reputation as a scientist if you haven't tried to be very careful in this kind of work. And it's this type of integrity, this kind of care not to fool yourself, that is missing to a large extent in much of the research in cargo cult science. A great deal of their difficulty is, of course, the difficulty of the subject and the inapplicability of the scientific method to the subject. Nevertheless, it should be remarked that this is not the only difficulty. That's why the planes don't land, but they don't land. We have learned a lot from experience about how to handle some of the ways we fool ourselves. One example, Millikan measured the charge of an electron by an experiment with falling oil drops and got an answer which we now know not to be quite right. It's a little bit off because he had the incorrect value for the viscosity of air. It's interesting to look at the history of measurements of the charge of electron after Millikan. If you plot them as a function of time, you find that one is a little bit bigger than Millikan's, and the next one's a little bit bigger than that, and the next one is a little bit bigger than that, until finally they settle down to a number which is higher. Why didn't they discover that the new number was higher right away? It's a thing that scientists are ashamed of, this history, because it's apparent that people did things like this. When they got a number that was too high above Millikan's, they thought something must be wrong, and they would look for and find a reason why something might be wrong. When they got a number closer to Millikan's value, they didn't look so hard. And so they eliminated the numbers that were too far off and did other things like that. We've learned those tricks nowadays, and now we don't have that kind of a disease. But this long history of learning how to not fool ourselves, of having utter scientific integrity, is, I'm sorry to say, something we haven't specifically included in any particular course that I know of. We just hope you've caught on by osmosis. The first principle is that you must not fool yourself. And you are the easiest person to fool. So you have to be very careful about that. And after you've not fooled yourself, it's easy not to fool other scientists. You just have to be honest in a conventional way after that. I would like to add something that's not essential to the science, but something I kind of believe, which is that you should not fool the layman when you're talking as a scientist. I'm not trying to tell you what to do about cheating on your wife, or fooling your girlfriend, or something like that, when you're not trying to be a scientist, but just trying to be an ordinary human being. We'll leave those problems up to you and your rabbi. I'm talking about a specific, extra type of integrity that is not lying, but bending over backwards to show how you're maybe wrong, that you ought to do when acting as a scientist. And this is our responsibility as scientists, certainly to other scientists, and I think to laymen. For example, I was a little surprised when I was talking to a friend who was going to go on the radio. He does work on cosmology and astronomy, and he wondered how he would explain what the application of his work were. "Well," I said, "there aren't any." He said, "Yes, but then we won't get support for more research of this kind." I think that's kind of dishonest. If you're representing yourself as a scientist, then you should explain to the layman what you're doing. And if they don't want to support you under those circumstances, then that's their decision. One example of the principle is this. If you've made up your mind to test a theory, or you want to explain some idea, you should always decide to publish it, whichever way it comes out. If we only publish results of a certain kind, we can make the argument look good. We must publish both kinds of results. For example, let's take advertising again. Suppose some particular cigarette has some particular property, like low nicotine. It's published widely by the company that this means it is good for you. They don't say, for instance, that the tars are a different proportion, or that something else is the matter with the cigarette. In other words, publication probably depends upon the answer. That should not be done. I say that's also important in giving certain types of government advice. Supposing a senator asked you for advice about whether drilling a hole should be done in his state, and you decide it would be better in some other state. If you don't publish such a result, it seems to me you're not giving scientific advice. You're being used. If your answer happens to come out in the direction the government or the politicians like, they can use it as an argument in their favor. If it comes out the other way, they don't publish it at all. That's not giving scientific advice. Other kinds of errors are more characteristic of poor science. When I was at Cornell, I often talked to the people in the psychology department. One of the students told me she wanted to do an experiment that went something like this. I don't remember it in detail, but it has been found by others that under certain circumstances X, rats did something A. She was curious as to whether if she changed the circumstances to Y, they would still do A. So her proposal was to do the experiment under circumstances Y and see if they still did A. I explained to her that it was necessary first to repeat in her laboratory the experiment of the other person, to do it under condition X to see if she could get result A, and then change to Y and see if A changed. Then she would know the real difference was the thing she thought she had under control. She was very delighted with this new idea and went to her professor. And his reply was, "No, you cannot do that, because the experiment has already been done and you would be wasting time." This was in about 1935 or so. So it seemed to have been the general policy then to not try to repeat psychological experiments, but only to change the conditions and see what happened. Nowadays, there's a certain danger of the same thing happening, even in the famous field of physics. I was shocked to hear of an experiment done at the big accelerator at the National Accelerator Laboratory, where a person used deuterium. In order to compare his heavy hydrogen results to what might happen to light hydrogen, he had to use data from someone else's experiment on light hydrogen, which was done on different apparatus. When asked, he said it was because he couldn't get the time on the program, because there's so little time and it's such an expensive apparatus, to do the experiment with light hydrogen on this apparatus because there wouldn't be any new result. And so the men in charge of programs at NAL are so anxious for new results in order to get more money to keep the thing going for public relations purposes, they are destroying, possibly, the value of the experiments themselves, which is the whole purpose of the thing. It is often hard for the experimenters there to complete their work as their scientific integrity demands. All experiments in psychology are not of this type, however. For example, there have been many experiments running rats through all kinds of mazes and so on, with little clear result. But in 1937, a man named Young did a very interesting one. He had a long corridor with doors all along one side where the rats came in, and doors along the other side where the food was. He wanted to see if he could train the rats to go in at the third door down from wherever he started them off. No. The rats went immediately to the door where the food had been the time before. The question was, how did the rats know? Because the corridor was so beautifully built and so uniform that this was the same door as before. Obviously, there was something about the door that was different from the other doors. So he painted the doors very carefully, arranging the textures on the faces of the doors exactly the same. Still, the rats could tell. Then he thought maybe the rats were smelling the food, so he used chemicals to change the smell after each run. Still, the rats could tell. Then he realized that the rats might be able to tell by seeing the lights and the arrangements in the laboratory, like any common sense person. So he covered the corridor, and still the rats could tell. He finally found that they could tell by the way the floor sounded when they ran over it. And he could only fix that by putting his corridor in sand. So he covered one after another of all possible clues and was finally able to fool the rats so they had to learn to go in the third door. And if he relaxed any of those conditions, the rats could tell. Now, from a scientific standpoint, that is a number one experiment. That is the experiment that makes rat running experiments sensible, because it uncovers the clues that the rat is really using, not what you think it's using. And that is the experiment that tells exactly what conditions you have to use in order to be careful and control everything in an experiment with rat running. I looked into the subsequent history of this research. The subsequent experiment and the one after that never referred to Mr. Young. They never used any of his criteria of putting the corridor on sand or being very careful. They just went right on running rats in the same old way and paid no attention to the great discoveries of Mr. Young, and his papers are not referred to because he didn't discover anything about rats. In fact, he discovered all the things you have to do to discover something about rats. But not paying attention to experiments like that is a characteristic of cargo cult science. Another example is the ESP experiments of Mr. Rhine and other people. As various people have made criticisms, and they themselves have made criticisms of their own experiments, they improve the techniques so that the effects are smaller and smaller and smaller until they gradually disappear. All the parapsychologists are looking for some experiment that can be repeated, that you can do again, to get the same effect, statistically even. They run a million rats. No, it's people this time. They do a lot of things and get a certain statistical effect. Next time they try it, they don't get it anymore. And now you find a man saying that this is an irrelevant demand to expect a repeatable experiment? This is science? This man also speaks about a new institution in a talk in which he was resigning as director of the Institute of Parapsychology. And in telling people what to do next, he says that one of the things they have to do is be sure they only train students who have shown their ability to get PSI results to an acceptable extent, not to waste their time on those ambitious and interested students who only get chance results. It is very dangerous to have such a policy in teaching. To teach students only how to get certain results, rather than how to do an experiment with scientific integrity. So I wish to you, I have no more time, so I just have one more wish for you. The good luck to be somewhere where you are free to maintain the kind of integrity I have described, and where you do not feel forced by a need to maintain your position in the organization, or financial support, or so on, to lose your integrity. May you have that freedom. May I also give you one last bit of advice? Never say that you'll give a talk unless you know clearly what you're going to talk about, and more or less what you're going to say.